Good afternoon, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier. It's Wednesday, March 31st. I'm your reader, Bob Young. The Courier is forecasting a brisk and chilly day today, with plenty of sunshine. We'll have a high of only 41 degrees and strong northwestern wind between 12 and 25 miles per hour. Clear tonight, with limited outdoor activity recommended. Plenty of sunshine tomorrow, Friday and Saturday. Sunday, increasing cloudiness and breezy in the afternoon. Sunrise this morning was at 6:54 a.m., and it sets tonight at 7:35 p.m. On the front page, we have a photograph of a man who's fishing on the Cedar River. He's wearing a heavy coat and a backpack and a hoodie, and the caption says, "A man casts a fishing line off the ledge along Cedar River near downtown Waterloo on Tuesday." The stories on the front page include police officer's cold stare recounted at trial, Texas facility packed with thousands of migrants, and we will begin with officials release rowers' names. Two Iowa State Crew Club members died after their boat capsized. This story was filed by Isabella Rosario of the Ames Tribune, and it begins with a photograph of boats dredging the river, and the caption says, "Law enforcement resumed the search for a missing Iowa State University Crew Club member on Monday, March 29, 2021, at Little Wall Lake in Hamilton County." The names of two Iowa State Crew Club members who died after their boat capsized on Little Wall Lake Sunday have been released by the Hamilton County Sheriff's Office and ISU Police Department. Yaakov Ben David, 20, a sophomore accounting major from Washington, D.C., and Derek Nanny, 19, was a freshman chemistry major from Normal, Illinois. The names of the other Crew Club members are not being released to protect their privacy, according to the release. Five members of the intercollegiate rowing team were practicing at the lake when their boat capsized, according to a university news release Sunday. Three of the students were treated and released from Mary Greeley Medical Center, officials said. The ISU Police Department is working with the Hamilton County Sheriff's Office and other agencies in the accident investigation, the news release said. Cold and windy conditions Sunday had made the lake pretty rough, Hamilton County Sheriff Douglas Timmons said. Little Wall Lake is a more than 18-mile drive north from Lead Recreational Center on the Ames campus. The closest location for observed weather reports listed by the National Weather Service's Des Moines office is Ames, and on Sunday, the average wind speed in Ames was 12.7 miles per hour. The highest observed wind speed on Sunday in Ames was 28 miles per hour, with the highest observed gust at 39 miles per hour, both from the northwest. The Iowa State Crew Club, founded in 2002, is a recognized student organization. No prior rowing experience is necessary to join. Counseling services are being provided to students through the Division of Student Affairs. Quote, "We extend our deepest condolences to the family and friends of the two students we lost on Sunday," Senior Vice President for Student Affairs Toya Younger said in the statement on Monday. Quote, "During this time of grief, I ask the entire Iowa State community to show compassion and support for one another. We know there are a lot of questions, and we are working to provide answers, but this will take time," unquote. Texas facility is packed with thousands of migrants. The story is filed by Elliot Spaggett and Noman Merchant of the Associated Press and begins with a photograph showing young women waiting on benches and some sitting behind computer terminals with the caption, "Young migrants get processed at the intake area of the Donna Department of Homeland Security holding facility." The main detention center for unaccompanied children in the Rio Grande Valley on Tuesday in Donna, Texas. Donna, Texas. More than 500 migrant children were packed into plastic-walled rooms built for 32 people, sitting inches apart on mats with foil blankets Tuesday at the largest U.S. Customs and Border Protection holding facility for unaccompanied youth. Overall, CBP's main child processing center a compound of white tents in Texas's Rio Grande Valley, held over 4,100 migrants, more than 3,400 of them children who traveled the U.S.-Mexico border alone. The rest of the migrants being housed were families. The facility, designed for 250 people under guidelines from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention during the coronavirus pandemic, adapted amid a spike in families and unaccompanied children crossing the border. The Biden administration allowed journalists to see the conditions for the first time since the facility opened on February 9th. A 3,200-square-foot space was divided into several rooms for 32 children each under CDC guidelines, each separated by thick plastic walls instead of the chain-link fence used by previous administration. Despite the health recommendations, one of the pods held almost 700 kids, another had almost 600, and others had just above 500. Everyone wore masks, but COVID-19 tests aren't done unless they show symptoms. Doors to the rooms were open for free movement, but there was little room to roam and no space to play games. Most children just sat on the ground close together, chatting quietly. Some were wrapped in foil blankets. Lights are dimmed at night. Children, most of them between 13 and 17, are separated by age. Families occupied a separate pod that was less crowded than the jam-packed rooms for older children. A room for tender-age children from 3 to 9 years old consisted of a walled playpen with mats on the floor and far more space than the 8 pods for older children. An 11-year-old boy cared for his 3-year-old sister, and a 17-year-old cared for her newborn. Quote, "I'm a Border Patrol agent. I didn't sign up for this," Oscar Escamilla, acting executive officer of the Border Patrol's Rio Grande Valley sector, said while looking at the younger kids. Children are processed in the tent facility in the town of Donna before being taken to longer-term care facilities run by the U.S. Health and Human Services, and then placed with a family member, relative, or sponsor. About 24 of some 270 children being transferred to the HHS Midday tested positive for COVID-19, the only time they are tested unless they exhibit symptoms earlier. Escamilla said the overall positivity rate at the Donna facility was about 14%. As they prepared to leave, children who tested negative for COVID-19 played soccer in the outdoor recreation area, where they can go 3 times a day when their pods are being cleaned. Those who tested positive for the virus gathered around metal benches off to the side and will still go to HHS centers. The Border Patrol is apprehending far more children daily than HHS is taking, leading to a severe backlog. The Border Patrol is not supposed to detain children for more than 3 days, but HHS lacks space. More than 2,000 kids have been at the Donna facility for more than 72 hours, including 39 for more than 15 days. One child has been there 20 days. The average stay is 133 hours. Quote, "The intent of the Border Patrol is not detention. We're not in the business of detention," said Escamilla, the official who supervised the media tour. Quote, "We're forced into the business because we can't turn them over to anybody," unquote. HHS is housing children at convention centers in Dallas and San Diego and is opening large-scale sites in San Antonio, El Paso, and elsewhere. A large HHS facility is being built near the holding center in Donna, separated by a chain-link fence. Noise from construction equipment filled the air near 7 buses that were to take children to other HHS facilities. About 250 to 300 children enter the Donna facility daily, and far fewer leave, a lopsided difference that Escamilla said was leading to more crowded conditions. It has held as many as 4,600 migrants. More than 17,000 unaccompanied children were in the U.S. custody as of Monday, about 12,000 with HHS, and the rest with Customs and Border Protection. On Monday, 446 children entered CBP custody, but only 229 went to HHS. HHS, which opened a facility Tuesday for 500 children at Fort Bliss in Texas, is working to build up to a capacity of 13,500 beds, spokesman Mark Weber said. Several hundred kids and teenagers are crossing the border daily, most fleeing violence, poverty, or the effects of natural disasters in Central America. President Joe Biden declined to resume his predecessor's practice of expelling unaccompanied children. But his administration continued expelling adults under a coronavirus-related public health declaration enacted by former President Donald Trump. Biden also tried to expel most families traveling together, but changes in Mexican law forced agents to release many patients and children into the U.S. A police officer's cold stare is recounted at trial, the story filed by the Associated Press, and begins with a photograph with the caption, "In this image from video, defense attorney Eric Nelson left and former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin right listen as Assistant Minnesota Attorney General Matthew Frank questions witness Donald Williams as Hennepin County Judge Peter Cahill presides Tuesday at the Hennepin County Courthouse in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Chauvin is charged in the May 25, 2020 death of George Floyd. Minneapolis. Onlookers grew increasingly angry as they begged Minneapolis officer Derek Chauvin to take his knee off George Floyd's neck, but Chauvin would not let up, and another officer forced back members of the crowd who tried to intervene. Witnesses testified Tuesday at Chauvin's murder trial. Witness after witness described how Chauvin was unmoved by their pleas, with the teenager who shot the harrowing video of the arrest that set off nationwide protests, testifying that the officer gave the crowd a cold and heartless stare. "He didn't care. It seemed as if he didn't care what we were saying," said 18-year-old Darnella Frazier, one of several witnesses who testified through tears. Chauvin continued to kneel on Floyd, while his fellow officer, To Tao, held the crowd of about 15 back, even when one of the onlookers identified herself as a firefighter and pleaded repeatedly to check Floyd's pulse, according to a witness and bystander video. Quote, "They definitely put their hands on the mace, and we all pulled back," Frazier told the jury. The firefighter, Guinevere Hansen, wept on the witness stand as she recalled how she was not allowed to give any medical assistance or tell the police what to do, such as administering chest compressions. Quote, "There was a man being killed," said Hansen, who testified in her dress uniform and detailed her emergency medical technician training. Quote, "I would have been able to provide medical attention to the best of my abilities, and this human was denied that right," unquote. Chauvin, 45, is charged with murder and manslaughter, accused of killing Floyd last May by pinning the 46-year-old handcuffed black man to the pavement for what prosecutors said was 9 minutes, 29 seconds. Floyd was arrested after being charged of trying to pass a counterfeit $20 bill at a convenience store. Floyd's death, along with a bystander video of him pleading that he couldn't breathe, triggered protests around the world and a reckoning over racism and police brutality across the U.S. The most serious charge against the now-fired white officer carries up to 40 years in prison. The defense argued that Chauvin did what his training told him to do and that Floyd's death was not caused by the officer, but by a combination of illegal drug use, heart disease, high blood pressure, and the adrenaline flowing through his body. On Tuesday, the prosecution asked witnesses to describe their horror at what they saw, buttressing the testimony with videos, some of which were never seen before. Many testified about feelings of helplessness and guilt as Floyd gasped for air, pleading for his life, and finally fell limp and silent, his eyes rolling back in his head. The testimony was apparently aimed at showing that Chauvin had multiple opportunities to think about what he was doing and change course. But Chauvin attorney Eric Nelson also sought to portray the onlookers as angry and agitated in an apparent attempt to show that the crowd posed a potential threat to police that might have distracted them during their encounter with Floyd. Earlier Tuesday, Donald Williams, one of the onlookers, testified that he called 911 after paramedics took Floyd away, quote, because I believed I witnessed a murder, unquote. In a recording of the emergency call, Williams could be overheard yelling at the officers, y'all is murderers, bro, unquote. Williams, a professional mixed martial arts fighter, initially admitted he was getting angrier, but then backtracked and said he was controlled and professional and was pleading for Floyd's life, but wasn't being heard. Williams said he was stepping on and off the curb, and at one point, Thau was controlling the crowd, put his hand on Williams's chest. Williams admitted under questioning that he told Thau he would beat the officers if Thau touched him again. But witnesses also testified that no bystanders actually interfered with police. When Fraser was asked by a prosecutor whether she saw violence anywhere on the scene, she replied, yes, from the cops, from Chauvin, and from Officer Thau. Also Tuesday, prosecutors played cell phone video recorded by yet another bystander, 18-year-old Alyssa Fornari, that showed onlookers shouting and screaming at Chauvin after Floyd stopped moving. The footage also showed Hansen, the Minneapolis firefighter, calmly walk up to Thau and offer to help before he ordered her back on the sidewalk. Quote, I felt like there wasn't really anything I could do as a bystander, a tearful Fornari said, adding that she felt she was failing Floyd. Quote, technically, I could have done something, but I couldn't really do anything physically because the highest power was there at the time, she said, referring to the police. Fraser testified that she looked at her father, another black man in her life, and thinks of, quote, how that could have been one of them, unquote. Quote, I stay up at night apologizing to George Floyd for not doing more, not saving his life, she said, adding of Chauvin, quote, it's not what I should have done, it's what he should have done, unquote. Let's turn the page to the Cedar Valley section. A novel idea. Cedar Falls author 84 publishes a book on recollection. The story is filed by Melody Parker and begins with a photograph of Wilma Edelmond Conrads. Cedar Falls. As a child, Wilma Edelmond Conrads thought Florence was a raven-haired, blue-eyed beauty, the most beautiful woman she'd seen in her life. Florence was her mom's best friend and ultimately a tragic figure of vivid memories she couldn't shake and whose story she wanted to tell someday. At 84, Edelmond Conrads finally did. The Cedar Falls writer's first book, Florence, was released in February by Newman Springs Publishing Incorporated. The historical novel is based on her personal recollections. Quote, it was a story that I just thought needed to be told, said Edelmond Conrads of Cedar Falls, a retired schoolteacher. Known as Jeannie to her friends, the author also is a singer and musician with her own band, Jeannie Uncorked. The Parkersburg native set her story in that small Iowa community. She wove Florence's story into the fabric of historical details about World War II and what life was like, particularly for women, on the home front during World War II. Quote, I was a kid, but I could see how everybody was involved and working to get the war over with as soon as possible, said Edelmond Conrads. Quote, people have no idea that in this day and age that women had no rights at that time. They took over working in factories and other men's jobs, but men still had total control over their wives. Young women have no idea how far we've come, she explained. As conflict spread around the globe, the author said Florence had her own heartbreaking battles at home being married to an abusive husband. Quote, she was a young woman out of Indiana. She just graduated from high school. She was raped by this guy, became pregnant, and her parents pushed her into marrying him because that's what you did in those days. She came to Parkersburg with him, and it ruined her life. Quote, she was badly abused. My folks, Minnie and Paul Edelmond, helped her. My mom was her best friend, and my dad stepped in many times to save her. My parents helped her to escape. Her little boy would have been dead if my parents hadn't helped. In the book, I compare her life to all the various battles in the war, and the last thing that happened to her, I compared to the dropping of the atom bomb, Edelmond Conrads explained. Quote, she was a really hard worker, and I felt so sorry for her. It was a tragedy. I had black hair and blue eyes like Florence did, and I wondered if I would grow up and be as pretty as she was. She was beaten so many times that after a while, though, you couldn't tell how pretty she'd been. Adelmond Conrads taught school for 41 years, including at Waterloo's Sacred Heart Church. She began working on the book 10 years ago, jotting down and organizing her recollections and refreshing her knowledge about World War II history, one of her favorite subjects and one she frequently taught. Quote, I don't consider myself a writer, although I've had a few poems published. As I wrote memories down, I'd remember something else. It took a long time, and when I was finally done, I handed my notebook to my husband, Abe, to read. He told her it was a page-turner and encouraged her to find a publisher. Adelmond Conrads married Abe at 16, and they had two children. She finished high school 20 years later and graduated from college the same year her oldest daughter, Janice, graduated from high school. She went to graduate school as well and taught from preschool through the eighth grade. She also loves making music. At 3, Wilma and her older sister, Pauline, began to sing and harmonize with their dad, who sang and played accordion and harmonica at county fairs, dances, and other events. Known for her ability to yodel, Adelmond Conrads has personally performed country music throughout Iowa, Missouri, and Arkansas, written dozens of songs, and recorded several CDs. Eventually, the author hopes to be able to participate in book signings and public readings with Florence when it's safe to do so, as COVID-19 restrictions are eased. The book is $16.95 and is available in several languages from online booksellers. Defense presents closing in babysitter abduction case filed by Jeff Reinitz and begins with a photograph of Saul Santos Vasquez Martinez, Waterloo. The attorney for a man accused of pulling a babysitter into his Cedar Falls home in 2019, said his actions didn't amount to kidnapping. Saul Santos Vasquez Martinez, 45, pleaded not guilty to charges of second-degree kidnapping and assault with intent to commit sexual abuse resulting in bodily injury. He waived his right to a jury trial, and testimony in his bench trial ended March 10th. On Friday, defense attorney Matthew Hoffey submitted written closings, arguments that the amount of time Vasquez held 16-year-old wasn't sufficient enough to meet the criteria for the kidnapping charge. Quote, the evidence presented here clearly shows that any confinement and/or removal was incidental to the underlying alleged offense, Hoffey argued. He also noted that Vasquez's blood alcohol level was 0.287 hours later when he talked to police, and he said the state didn't prove the teen suffered a bodily injury. Prosecutors had earlier claimed that pulling her into the house greatly increased the chances the crime would go unnoticed and increased the danger the girl faced. In their closings, both sides cited a prior state Supreme Court decision surrounding the 1979 kidnapping case of Guy Eugene Rich. Rich, a mall custodian, abducted a clothing store manager at Crossroads Shopping Center at closing time, sexually abused her, and threw her into a large trash bin before disappearing to Las Vegas with the night deposit. In the babysitter case, Vasquez allegedly photographed the teen and the 6-year-old girl she was looking after as they played outside in Cedar Falls in July 2019. When the younger girl went inside to watch TV, the babysitter remained outside to clean up, and Vasquez, who didn't know the girls, yelled over to the babysitter. When she approached to see what he wanted, he pulled her into the house and into the bedroom, groping and kissing her and trying to remove her clothing. It took 2 attempts before she was able to escape, according to her testimony. She received a scratch mark to the chest during the ordeal. When questioned by police, Vasquez first denied anything happened, saying he had been sleeping, but then admitted to touching the girl, but denying he kept her from leaving. Prosecutors have the option of issuing a written rebuttal to the defense's closings, and District Court Judge Brad Harris will issue a verdict in the case at a later date. In the public safety roundup, New charge alleges second victim in child porn case, Cedar Rapids. A federal grand jury has added charges against a local mixed martial arts fighter who is fighting child porn charges, alleging a second victim. The panel issued a superseding indictment on March 16th, charging Travis John Fulton, 43, of Parkersburg, with a second count of sexual exploitation of a child. The new charge alleges he enticed a minor, identified as Jane Doe No. 1, to engage in sexual behavior for the purpose of filming or photographing over the span of several years. The earlier exploitation charge, handed down in February, alleged similar conduct with another girl. He was also charged with receipt and possession of child porn at that time. The charging language in the superseding indictment expands the dates for the child porn possession offense by several years, going back to 2013. Fulton pleaded not guilty to the new charge during a March 24th court appearance, and he remains in custody. Fulton is also awaiting trial for domestic violence charges for a September 2019 incident in state court. State corrections officials allege Fulton violated his pretrial release on the domestic assault charge by leaving the state without the court's permission to participate in a sanctioned MMA fight in Topeka, Kansas, in November 2019. Man arrested for selling photos, Cedar Falls. An Ankeny man has been arrested under a new sexploitation charge after he allegedly sold nude photos of his ex-girlfriend from Cedar Falls. Authorities allege that after the breakup, Devin Jamal Helms, 21, pretended to be the woman in the photos and distributed the images through social media accounts, collecting money through the Venmo app. Quote, "We are finding this to be quite common, that people are selling their photos and other people's photos," said Captain Jeff Sitzman with the Cedar Falls Police Department. He said people use social media accounts to post partially revealing photos and offering to release the full photos for a price. In the Cedar Falls case, police said Helms had a relationship with the woman for a few months in 2019, and the two exchanged photos, according to court records. After the relationship ended, Helms allegedly set up a social media account under a made-up name. He used the account to sell fully nude photos of the woman without her consent, court records state. Sitzman said friends of the woman eventually saw the photos, and Cedar Falls police were notified about the incident in May 2020. Investigators tracked the money and found Helms' bank account at the end, he said. Quote, "We are able to get that Venmo account's information. Venmo accounts are associated with the bank account," he said. Police obtained an arrest warrant charging Helms with first-degree harassment in October 2020, using a section of the Iowa Code added a few years ago to address the dissemination of nude or sexual images without consent, Sitzman said. On Monday, Helms was arrested on the warrant. Man uses mower as getaway, Waterloo. A Waterloo man used a riding lawnmower as a getaway vehicle after breaking into a garage, according to police. Officers obtained a surveillance video showing James Howard Harrington holding the loot from the Independence Avenue garage while struggling to keep the John Deere mower on course as he headed home around 4 a.m. on March 13th, according to court records. Police said the stolen items can be seen in the video. That same night, Harrington also allegedly took a $43 bottle of Absolut vodka from the Yes Way convenience store at 1976 Franklin Street, police said. He then rode off on the mower, court records state. Court records indicate Harrington's driver's license is barred until November 2024. Officers arrested Harrington, 54, of 1321 Calhoun Street on Tuesday for third-degree burglary, fifth-degree theft, and driving while barred. Bond was set at $7,500. Harrington is also awaiting trial for a June 2020 incident where he is accused of taking $112 in cash from Vet's Truck Wash on North Elk Run Road and driving off in a 2005 Dodge Caravan, according to court records. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Wednesday, March 31st, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Elk Run Heights. Lonnie L. Gage, 55, of Elk Run Heights, Iowa, died Saturday, March 27, 2021, at Unity Point Allen Hospital in Waterloo. He was born January 8, 1966, in Waterloo, the son of Leo and Carol, maiden name Skopbeck Gage. He graduated from Waterloo East High School in 1984 and from Hawkeye Tech in Auto Body Restoration in 1986. Lonnie worked at John Deere as a maintenance plumber in the foundry. He volunteered at the Hudson Fire Department for over 18 years. He played on softball teams throughout Cedar Valley for over 20 years. He had a passion for his cars and motorcycles. He is survived by his son, Austin, spouse, Christy Gage, Indianola, his parents, Leo and Carol Gage of Evansdale, two brothers, Vernie, spouse, Teresa Gage of Elk Run Heights, and Leo Jr., spouse, Heather Gage of Greenville, South Carolina, two grandchildren, Jackson and J.C., several nephews and a niece, Zach, Nick, Aaron, Ethan, Logan, and Reese. Visitation will be at 11 a.m. to 1 o'clock p.m. Saturday, April 3, 2021, at Kern's Funeral Service, Kimball Chapel, Waterloo, with funeral services at 1 o'clock p.m., burial, Garden of Memories Cemetery. Family and friends are gathering at Lofty's Lounge, 3480 Lafayette Road, Evansdale, following the committal service. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the family. Go to www.kernsfuneralservice.com for more information. Tukwila. Joseph Michael Hill, age 61, of Tukwila, Washington, passed away February 21, 2021, at his home. He was born March 24, 1959, in Waterloo, Iowa, the son of Gary and Patricia, maiden name Steffensmeyer, Hill. Following high school, Joe served in the U.S. Navy for 10 years. Joe worked and retired as Chief Technology Officer for Steeler Incorporated in Seattle. Survived by his sister, Jeanne, spouse Mark Butler, of Marysville, Washington, loving nieces and many friends. Preceded in death by his parents, two brothers, David Patrick Hill and Curtis James Hill, and a sister, Joni Lee Mueller. Family-directed memorial services will be at a later date. Burial took place in Greenwood Cemetery in Cedar Falls, Iowa. Clyde T. White, Jr., 73, of Waterloo, died Sunday, March 23, 2021, at Unity Point Health Allen Hospital in Waterloo. He was born March 11, 1948, in Des Moines, son of Clyde T. Sr. and Wilma L. Geezer White. He graduated from Southeast Polk High School in 1966. He served in the U.S. Marine Corps from 1971 to 1986. Clyde worked at Zanotti Armor as a production worker making gun safes for many years. He was a member of Waterloo VFW Post number 1623 and was an avid collector of decanters, of which he had many. Clyde is survived by his son, Joe, spouse Jeanette White of Indianola, three daughters, Terry Walton of Bland, Missouri, Tracy White of Des Moines, and Jessica, spouse Nicholas White in Waverly, 11 grandchildren, 14 great-grandchildren, significant other Valerie Hockey, three sisters, Pam, spouse Steve, Kirby of Fort Wayne, Indiana, Phyllis Culver, Charita, Arizona, and Janet Green of Bremerton, Washington, and a brother, Carol White of Des Moines, preceded in death by his parents, two brothers, Herbert, Nave, and James White, and a sister, Sharon Kaufman. Visitation is from 4 o'clock to 7 o'clock p.m. Thursday, April 1st, with military honors at 4 o'clock p.m. at Locke Funeral Home, conducted by Waterloo VFW Post number 1623, Waterloo American Legion Post 138, and United States Marine Corps Funeral Honor Guard. Memorials may be directed to Blackhawk County Veterans Affairs. Visit www.veterans.org. www.lockfuneralhome.com for more information. Dennis Craig Neeson, 67, of Waterloo, died Tuesday, March 30th, at Mercy One Waterloo. Memorial services will be held at a later date, with interment in Pleasant View Cemetery in Applington. Haggerty Wyckoff Grarup Funeral Service on South Street is in charge of arrangements. Let's read the sports page now. Missouri Valley Conference Volleyball Tournament. The story opens with a photograph of Northern Iowa's Emily Holterhaus as she goes for a kill against Illinois State during the MVC Championships at the McLeod Center in Cedar Falls in 2019. Consistent play is key for Panthers. UNI opens MVC tournament play Thursday versus Drake. Story filed by Jim Nelson. It's anybody's tournament to win. Northern Iowa volleyball coach Bobby Peterson says that it is nearly always the case when it comes to the Missouri Valley Conference volleyball tournament, but this season Peterson feels the parity pertaining to the 2021 event, which begins Thursday at Illinois State's Redbird Arena, is stronger than past seasons due to the fact 7 of the 8 qualifiers finished with 8 conference wins or more. Quote, that is the thing about the conference this year. If you look across the board, it is that way, unquote, Peterson said. Quote, there is really no one, even Evansville and Southern Illinois, two teams that didn't make the tournament, had some great matches against all of the teams. Quote, I don't know what the reasons are, but I think this has been one of those years. It always is anyone's tournament, but I just think this year, because of how the conference unfolded, you could really say that on paper as well this year. It makes a whole lot of fun. UNI opens tournament play at 5 p.m. inside against in-state rival Drake. The two teams meet what seems like a lifetime ago for Peterson. The Bulldogs, 13-6 overall and 11-5 MVC, snapped a 47-match losing streak to the Panthers, a streak that dated back to 1996 in the two teams' first match of the year on January 22nd. Then a week later, Drake won again at the McLeod Center. Both matches went 4 sets. Quote, the first time we played them was the very first match of the season, Peterson said. It has been a while ago. We have seen them a lot on video just because of scouting other opponents. A really talented group. Quote, it was a team that was last in the league last year and now is second in the league. It just shows the growth in the program, unquote. Peterson said the Bulldogs have an MVC Player of the Year candidate in Haley Bush, who had 28 kills in the two matches against UNI. Quote, she was a huge difference maker, Peterson said of Drake going from last to second. Quote, but I think they are very well balanced in some areas and just play really good defense. I think they are very similar to Bradley in terms of their defense and what they do. They are really strong at blocking and just digging a lot of balls, unquote. Consistency will be the word Peterson uses a lot as her team prepares for the match. She said her young and inexperienced team has had a full slate of matches to improve, and now Panthers need to go out and execute the things they got better at consistency for an entire match. Quote, we've seen a lot of growth in our team in a lot of different ways throughout the season, and now we have an opportunity to come together, put it together, and see what we've got, Peterson said. A bright spot is UNI seems to have more options offensively, and as a group, their pass-receive game has been the biggest growth of late, which has allowed freshman setter Taylor Alden to better distribute the ball. Sophomore Emily Holterhaus led UNI with 28 kills in the first two matches against Drake. She will need to have a good match Thursday, but Peterson said that goes for players such as Inga Roto, Carly Spies, Kay Lisa Andorfer, Yagmer Cannell, and back row players Bailey Peterson and Sarah Kunovadov. I think we have a lot of really capable players who can step up, Peterson said. Quote, to me, anyone who has stepped up has not been a surprise. I know they were capable of doing that. Taylor has done a really good job, and sometimes that connection is better with certain players, and she can feel that, so the ball is probably going to go to that player. Quote, and then I think other nights it is everyone. It is everyone being consistent, so we have that opportunity to go to anyone and everyone at the same time. And that is the most ideal thing, is to be able for Taylor to have every option available, unquote. In the NCAA women's basketball tournament, South Carolina drubs Texas 62-34 to reach the Final Four, filed by the Associated Press. San Antonio. One by one, South Carolina players walked through the confetti and climbed the ladder to cut down the net in the Alamodrome. It was only fitting that the Gamecocks got to keep the nylon. They used it way more than Texas did. Zia Cook scored 16 points, and South Carolina used its stifling defense to advance to the Final Four for the third time, shutting down Texas for a 62-34 victory Tuesday night. Top-seeded South Carolina blocked 14 shots, 9 by Leticia Amahir, and held number 6 Texas to 23% shooting. The Longhorns were outscored 10-0 in the fourth quarter. The Gamecocks have been on a mission ever since they felt they were denied a real chance at the national title last season when the NCAA tournament was canceled because of the pandemic. It showed all night long, but especially during the first scoreless quarter in the tourney since the women's game went to quarters in 2016. Quote, "It says they're locked in," South Carolina coach Dawn Staley said. "They have been focused. They wanted this opportunity to get to the Final Four. They know nothing about what they just accomplished. I like who we're bringing to this Final Four." South Carolina, 26-4, won the Hemisphere region to advance to Friday's national semifinal against the winner of Tuesday night's Alamo regional final, number 1, Stanford, and number 2, Louisville. Destany Henderson and Victoria Saxton each scored 12 for the Gamecocks, and Amahir also had 10 points and 8 rebounds in a terrific all-around performance. South Carolina ran out to a 19-point lead in the third quarter and responded to a Texas run with a burst started by a 3-pointer from Henderson. Then it put a lid on the basket in the fourth. Quote, "We don't back down from anyone," Cook said. "We just made sure we put our foot on the gas, kept our guard up, and did what we needed to do," unquote. Staley ran her championship game record against Texas's Vic Schaefer to 6-0, dating to when they faced each other in the SEC when Schaefer was at Mississippi State. That includes beating Schaefer in the 2017 national final. Quote, "They contest you at everything you do, whether a three-point range or at the rim," Schaefer said. "That's a reflection of Dawn. To me, those kids really embody probably how she was as a player." Schaefer took the Texas job in April 2020 and coaxed an impressive postseason run out of the Longhorns behind a grinding defense that carried the school to the brink of its first women's Final Four since 2003. Texas was looking to become just the third number 6 seed to make the Final Four since Notre Dame in 1997. Quote, "This feeling right now, it's tough," said guard Kyra Lambert, who played at least 38 minutes in Texas's last 3 games and provided the go-ahead basket against Maryland in the Sweet 16. "This is not how I pictured this to end." The Longhorns looked tired and a step slow after tough wins over UCLA and Maryland. They may have simply been worn out by the time they matched up with the big and quick Gamecocks, who pressured the ball on the perimeter and denied shots inside. Audrey Warren led the Longhorns 21-10 with 13 points. Stanford 78, Louisville 63. Lexi Hull scored 21 points, and Stanford reached the Final Four by rallying to a victory over Louisville. Next up for the top-seeded Cardinal is South Carolina on Friday night in a rematch of the 2017 national semifinals. Stanford dropped that one 62-53, ending its previous appearance in the Final Four. UConn and Arizona meet in the other national semifinal. Stanford, 29-2, trailed by 12 midway through the third quarter before scoring 13 consecutive points to take its first lead since early in the game. The teams traded baskets the rest of the period, and number 2 seed Louisville, 26-4, was up 50-48 heading into the final quarter. The Cardinal scored the first 9 points of the fourth to go up 58-50. That run was capped by Kiana Williams's 3-pointer. The San Antonio native had a rough start to the game, missing 11 of her first 12 shots. She finally got going offensively, hitting 4 shots in a row to help Stanford build its lead. Stanford was up 68-60 with just over 3 minutes left when Williams hit a step-back 3 that sealed the victory. She finished with 14 points. And now in the men's NCAA basketball tournament, quite a show. Zags stay undefeated with 85-66 win over USC. And the story begins with a photograph of a smiling Gonzaga head coach Mark Few as he celebrates after an Elite Eight game against Southern California in the NCAA men's basketball tournament at Lucas Oil Stadium on Tuesday. Indianapolis, filed by the Associated Press. Can anybody stop these guys? For the fourth straight time this season, Gonzaga answered that question with a resounding no. The Bulldogs got on a roll and put on a show, cruising into the Final Four with an 85-66 beatdown of a Southern California team that was nowhere near ready for what it ran into on Tuesday night. Drew Timm had 23 points and 5 rebounds, and after one dunk, pretended to slick down his handlebar mustache for the few thousand fans in the stands. Quote, "This is a really, really big deal," Coach Mark Few said of the program's return to the Final Four after a 4-year hiatus. "And Zags know how we to celebrate, okay?" The top-seeded and top-ranked Bulldogs will be the third team to bring an undefeated record into the Final Four since the bracket expanded to 64 teams in 1985. The last team to go undefeated was Indiana in 1976. On Saturday in the national semifinals, the Zags will face the winner of a later Elite Eight matchup between UCLA and Michigan. Timm did whatever he wanted against the nation's fourth-ranked defense, a team that won its first 3 tournament games by an average of 21 points, as did pretty much everyone else in a white uniform. Jalen Suggs finished with 18 points, 9 rebounds, and 8 assists. All-American Corey Kispert had 18 points and 8 boards and an off night, only 6-for-19 from the floor. Gonzaga got 44% in the second half and, quote, only 50% for the game. That was 5 under its nation-leading average, but it didn't matter much. Quote, "We just tried to stay moving," Suggs said about attacking the USC zone, which had been shutting down teams all month in Indy. Quote, "We didn't let the ball get too sticky. We kept moving, flashing into the high post. It was a lot for them to deal with. Good cuffs off the baseline, vertical cuts off the wings. Blowouts are supposed to be boring, but this had the feel of a Globetrotters game at times, filled with fancy bounce passes through traffic, reverse layups, a swooping power dunk from Joel Olai, 9 points, and the occasional post-basket flex from the 6'10" Timm. Gonzaga led 6th-seeded USC 7-0 after 2 minutes, 25-8 after 8 minutes and 30 seconds, and 36-15 after Kispert took a nifty dish from Timm for an easy layup from 6 minutes and 3 seconds left in the half. Quote, "It was a little surprising," USC coach Andy Enfield said, quote, "because we've been playing great basketball," unquote. The Zags have a way about doing that to people. They walked into the locker room at halftime ahead by 19 with a big fat 0 in the turnover column, a gold standard stat for a team that thrives on offensive efficiency. The last 20 minutes were extended garbage time. Plenty of time for Timm to wax his handlebar mustache and for the Bulldogs to pad the stats. They are a statistician's dream, a team that came in number 1 scoring 91.8, that has won 29 of its 30 games by double digits, and that wasn't going to be slowed by the brothers Mobley, Isaiah and Evan, who roamed the middle for one of the country's tallest teams. Average height is 6'7", UCLA 51, Michigan 49. Johnny Juzang poured in 28 points while playing most of the second half on a hurt ankle, and UCLA survived a series of nail-biting misses by top-seeded Michigan in the closing seconds for a victory night that made the Bruins the fifth number 11 seed ever to reach the Final Four. After dictating the pace all game, eschewing the slick style of Michigan in favor of a rock fight, it only seemed fitting that the underdog Bruins, with two overtime wins in the tournament already, would take it to the buzzer. They were clinging to a 50-49 lead when Michigan called a timeout with 19 seconds to go. Juwan Howard set up an open three-point look for a cold-shooting Franz Wagner, who missed most of everything, and Eli Brooks missed a putback before UCLA was able to corral the rebound. The Wolverines quickly fouled and sent Juzang to the line, where he missed the second of his two free throws with 6.3 seconds left, and Michigan grabbed the rebound. After another timeout, Mike Smith raced up the court and unloaded a good look from the wing and was halfway down before bouncing back out. The buzzer sounded, but the officials halted the Bruins celebration, putting a half second back on the clock. That was enough time for Michigan to inbound to Wagner, who again let fly a three-pointer that clanked off the iron, and finally gave the Bruins freedom to spring from their benches in a wild celebration. Tiger Campbell added 11 points for UCLA, 22-9, which will play overall number one seed Gonzaga in the national semifinals. Let's turn back to the Cedar Valley section for some more local news. In the Call the Courier column, question, I got a letter from CFU about the freeze down in Texas that my bill would go up over $500. Is this an issue with poorly managed utilities? How on earth can I be responsible to pay such a large amount when I am in Iowa? Answer, even though our utilities were weatherized against sub-freezing temperatures, Texas wasn't, and places like Cedar Falls Utilities and Mid-American Energy and many others buy a lot of natural gas from Texas, which produces the most natural gas in the United States. When the cold temperatures there disrupted that, production dropped by 45% in Texas during the week ended February 13th, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. At the same time, production was cut nearly in half. Natural gas was in high demand due to cold temperatures across much of the United States, and that combination led to prices spiking enormously for 5 days straight. CFU largely paid that out of their reserves, and along with other utility companies, expect to make that up from their customers over the next several months. It's possible that you can get some help with your utility bills. The recently passed American Rescue Plan allocated $4.5 billion to help toward LIHEAP, which helps people pay for home heating and cooling costs. You can apply for LIHEAP in Blackhawk County by calling Operation Threshold in Waterloo at this phone number, 291-2065, or in Buchanan County by calling Operation Threshold in Independence at 334-6081. In Bremer County, call the Northeast Iowa Community Action Corporation in Waverly at this phone number, 352-4532. Question, now that the Cedar Falls poultry ordinance has passed, will people be butchering them on their property? Answer, the ordinance still says no one can butcher or otherwise process any animal or fowl on public property or within the sensory perception of any person not on the same premises on private property. Cedar Falls Director of Community Development, Stephanie Hawk Sheets, said city staff has generally advised people that means they're only able to butcher them in a closed garage or shed, unquote. Question, what is the black population in Waverly, not counting the students at Wartburg? Answer, the black population is estimated at 2% in the city of Waverly, compared to 1.2% in Bremer County, according to the U.S. Census estimate for 2019. The black population in Blackhawk County is 9.7%, while in Cedar Falls it is 2.5%, and in Waterloo is at 16.7%. Wartburg is estimated to have a 4.1% black student population. According to the Census Bureau's official residence criteria for 2020, college students are counted at their usual residence as of the date of the census, meaning if they're living there and sleeping there most of the time, it's their home. Question: what is the contact address for U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson? Answer: according to hinson.house.gov, you may mail the Congresswoman a letter at her Washington, D.C. office at 1429 Longworth House Office Building, Washington, D.C., 20515, or try her Waterloo office at 521A Lafayette Street, Waterloo, Iowa, 50703. Question: how many are Republicans, Democrats? How many are active, non-active in the League of Women Voters? May you supply me with contact information? Answer: we're not exactly sure what you're asking, but we can get you the contact information for the local chapter. Visit the League of Women Voters of Blackhawk and Bremer Counties at lwvbhb.org or email the chapter's president, Sherry Dargan, at sherrydargan@gmail.com. And that's spelled C-H-E-R-I-E-D-A-R-G-A-N. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Wednesday, March 31st. I'm your reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And you may wish to stay tuned to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, which follows shortly. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.